Welcome to the Trekking Connections podcast, and thanks for listening.
We feature voices from around the world sharing stories of working intentionally with deep nature connection in ways that transform lives, families, projects, and communities. I'm Sarah.
I'm Aiden.
And I'm John.
And we are your hosts from Living Connection First.
Hey, everybody. Aiden here. I'm excited that we're joined today by George Buman.
This is John, and I'm really, really happy to be friends with George, be able to have this conversation with you today, George. And we have a lot to cover, but I'm really happy to be with you here, George.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with the two of you. Thanks for having me.
You know, if you listen to the podcast with Dan Gardoki and Sarah and myself and Aiden, Dan and I were kind of reflecting back on how we sort of pioneered a model where, you know, 40, 50 people could learn bird language at the same time much more efficiently. And so we developed that into quite a workshop structure, and it continues to evolve. But we have run this class called the Bird Language Intensive, which sort of came to a halt during the pandemic for obvious reasons, and haven't really gotten back into it. But we use it here and there. And I was running a workshop in Pescadero, California at Green Oaks Creek Farm, beautiful spot for bird language, forested mountain up on one side, a bunch of farm fields and transition zones, a creek running by, great habitat and great views. So we could, you know, see the peregrine falcon coming in. We could, you know, see the Cooper's hawk flying, and we could pick up all the bird alarms, right? And we had other options with cats and ravens robbing nests. And normally when I'm teaching this course, facilitating really, you know, we offer some basic teachings of how to recognize bird language. And then we break people into small groups and they all go out and sit. And then when the groups come back, they all map everything that they experienced. And then we start to have the discussion as a whole group. And I recognized this one guy, this one participant, quote unquote, who very quickly became an instructor. And I'm like, who is this guy? This guy knows so much about bird and animal language, and he can imitate the ravens and he can imitate the coyotes. And, you know, and that was you, George. And we invited you to our staff debrief, you know, because of your extraordinary and rare competency. Like, you know, almost nobody knows this stuff. And my big question is, like, how come you do?
Well, thank you for that. And honestly, that trip for me was as much of an opportunity to say thank you to you as it was to be a part of that amazing group of folks at Pescadero. From the time I was a kid, I needed to know. And I didn't always know what there was to know, but I knew that there was just all these wild lives going on and around mine. And I was just like, where are they? Who are they? What are they doing? And that's been my life. I've pulled on everything and everybody I could find to navigate just having my finger on the pulse of the wild around us.
Now, I hear that. I get it. I mean, I also was like you when I was a kid. But I can point at my grandmother and say that she had a lot to do with that fire being lit in my belly, right? Because if it wasn't for her constant mentoring and attention and almost daily catch my story, give me another cool thing to do, right? Which I just couldn't wait to do. You know, exploring ponds and swamps and catching frogs and snakes and turtles and, you know, doing all that. But she really lit my fire and she helped me build up momentum as a boy that was totally stoked on errands. And I always want to know, like, did you have influences like that?
I did. And they were scattered. You know, my grandfather was always, he was always one of my central mentors, but he hunted and he fished and we spent a lot of time. In fact, I spent more time with my grandfather and his brother than I did with my own peer group. Like I get off the school bus and it was up to my grandfather's house or we go out ice fishing or fishing in the boat. And he was a historian also. So he helped start a museum that covered 10,000 years of history in the area I grew up in. So every time we went out, it was stories about, you know, the Paleo-Indian culture of that area, the Owasco, the Iroquois, the Huron trips with Samuel Champlain and, you know, the Bateau. Sir William Johnson was taking across the lake and through that stretch of the river in the French and Indian War. So, you know, a lot of place-based experience and a draw. And for me, it was the hunting and fishing and trapping even were the things you did. Like, nobody went for a bird walk. Like, that was just, I never even knew that existed for years, honestly, until probably college. And so a lot of it I made up, or I learned initially through whatever outdoor activities were on the table for me. And I pursued them doggedly. You know, I read everything I could find. I tried everything I could find. You know, early on, I got a copy of Tom's book on trapping and snares and friction fire and all these different things, shelter. I don't remember the exact title of that book, but I went through everything. I tried everything, and some things stuck and some things didn't. But then I pulled on other people. Like, I just always fascinated with things I could have a conversation with, even if it was from the perspective of where I started, you know, so ducks and geese and turkeys and things that could be pursued. You know, I met a family friend who was a master duck caller. Another guy taught me to call ducks. I just cold called a state turkey calling champion and said, "Hey, you don't know me, but I want to learn this." And so it was just kind of, you know, the central theme of the place I grew up in. A lot of the inspiration to be out there was through my grandfather, but then started assembling just anybody I could find connections to or a phone number for, and filling in the gaps that interested me.
You know, it makes me want to reflect a little bit on the influence of your grandfather's storytelling, where the landscape suddenly had a narrative, right? It wasn't just a bunch of trees and plants. There was history. Exactly. And I could see how those stories would cause a young boy's imagination to just really, really expand into possibility and adventure and mystery. And, you know, like, this land is talking in so many ways.
Oh, yeah.
I remember you telling me a story about how when you were young, you started to figure out what the squirrels were saying, and you learned to imitate the gray squirrels, and they would give alarms for different things. And you were noticing that pattern, which in and of itself is remarkable, because I noticed most children in modern times, you know, they'll hear squirrels making noise, but they say to themselves, "Oh, the squirrel is making noise." You know, it ends there. They don't dig further into, why is that squirrel making that sound, you know? Talk a little bit about that relationship with the gray squirrel. And by the way, George is a really incredible mimic. And he's not just mimicking, but he's also mimicking with meaning. So he's making the sound, but he knows what the sound means. And if you heard it, he would know what it indicated, which is really, really fun.
Yeah, to me it was, I think you've said it before, you had to have a reason. And to me, the reason was initially was I was pursuing them. But at a certain level, that wasn't enough for me. I wanted to know what the deer, the squirrel were doing when it wasn't hunting season, like when they had their kids, when they were, what was going on in the spring, what was going on in late winter. And that ultimately compelled me to really pay attention in ways I hadn't before. And I just started noticing differences, you know, and asking why. Well, why does the squirrel go, "Wah!" In some instances, and sometimes it's just tail end, that you know, and so there's a reason. It costs energy. There's something behind that that is affecting their life. And just spending enough time out there was like, oh my gosh, this one's usually done when I show up. You know, the ground assault. Kind of the chuffing in the start, and then the fingernails on the chalkboard at the end. But then there was just the fingernails on the chalkboard end, and that's when the red-tail hawk went over.
Ah.
You know, that's when something else happened. It was like, just started trying to see the world more deeply through their eyes.
Yeah, so starting with duck calling, and then turkey calling, and then naturally figuring out to imitate the things that you were hearing, which, of course, I know what that does. It helps us learn it at a level that, you know, our heads can't do alone. Like, somehow by the, you know, what Dr. Bill Sutherland always talks about, the mimetics, you know, that of mimicry. which gets us to experience the world through our body, which activates, instead of our left brain being dominant, which is all about thinking about things, it also opens up our access to the right brain, which has that bigger spatial putting all the pieces together, you know, the greater awareness, you know. So, you know, how much did mimicry play a role for you? Obviously a lot, because you do a perfect gray squirrel.
It is huge. Like, I can't overstate that enough. Mimicry has been my life. It was the easiest channel to my best teacher. So for me, it wasn't people. It was the animals themselves. And the most accessible route to that was through their language, body language, vocal language, etc. And that by reproducing it, like you're saying, John, I involve my intercostal muscles between my ribs and my diaphragm and my voice box and my lips and my mouth. And so as I make these sounds, I am creating a union between me and that creature. You know, you could even simplify it to the point of, like, when you learn an instrument and you hit a chord, and no, it just doesn't sound right because you didn't have your finger in the right position relative to the fret. And so I make that squirrel call, and I listen to it actually do it. And I'm like, no, I was off. There was something. So I'll try it again. And so out of that, it cements this multi-sensory space and moment, really. Like, a lot of these calls, like, I remember the first time I really engaged with that, when I heard that, when I tried to copy that, I was on this, what I called the Oak Island in the swamp across the lake from my house. Like, I'm back there. I'm in that space with that squirrel looking up into the red oaks and the sun hitting off the high points of those flat ridges that they have on their trunks. And so for me, over time, I realized, I didn't then quite often, but I realized that the imitation was really about bending and morphing myself around the space that creature existed. And so in some ways became part of it, became part of them. So when I heard that again, I didn't just pick it up as a sound. I felt it more deeply throughout all of my soma, you know, my flesh and bones.
Yeah, I want to pick up on that in a minute, but I want to give Aidan a chance to reflect, especially since you drew the music metaphor.
Yeah, my first reflection is thinking back to being 7, 8 years old and climbing the white pine tree in our yard. And I didn't just climb the white pine tree as a human. Like, I was always imagining I was a gray fox, right? And I wanted to be the gray fox, you know? And I have also always had an affinity to the squirrels, you know? And I sometimes wonder, like, I was an exceptional climber, you know? I mean, I was around all sorts of other children all the time, and I could climb things that no one else could climb. I could climb things that the teenagers couldn't climb, you know? And, you know, where did that come from? And it's weird because I don't think that we choose our affinities. I really don't. Like, you know, you're walking through the forest and, you know, oh, okay, yeah, there's a woodpecker, whatever, you know, but then you hear the squirrel and you're like, oh, what's that? You know, and for me, it's like I'm looking through the field guide and kind of every animal kind of shows up the same. And then you get to the gray fox and all of a sudden I'm obsessed. And I don't, you know, like, I don't understand that, but like, there's something to that. And when I think about mimicry within music, I think about it with the imitating of the animals and, you know, or imitating, you know, humor, all of these things, it really does feel like, yeah, we're just taken by it. And it is this incredible experience. Like, it does motivate me so much, because it's like, there's no better feeling than sort of that full embodiment of that experience, you know, and what you were saying too, about how you really are sort of taking on a little bit of the perspective of that animal or musician, or, you know, pick whatever it is, but there's just something about bringing it to life in that way that is just deeper than thinking about it alone.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And that's, yeah. That's great. And that's the thing I didn't get from just the sportsman route, That's the thing I didn't honestly get through all my schooling and degrees in wildlife ecology. I didn't want to just see and experience these wild beings from arm's length. I didn't always want to be objective. I wanted to be involved so that when I heard that call, it meant something to me. It told me to run ahead to that next knoll and wait for a few minutes, you know, to see what was going to show up. It's a vocabulary that it's silly that it's lost the way it has been in modern times. And I envy the ways in which those of all of our ancestors practiced it in the past. But it's great to know that you all are out there too, and there are ways to rebuild this.
Well, I want to pick up that thread that I'm sure the listeners probably picked up on it too, that when you started to describe the oak tree and the flat ridge on the bark with the sun and the squirrel up there, and, you know, like it's not just a memory, it's like a place you can actually go and experience it anew. And like, as I experienced it when you were sharing it with us with that really wonderful storyteller's mind that you have, you brought us there, you know, and I was standing there with you and I was feeling the feelings that you were feeling in that moment. Like it was like, I was having a whole somatic experience of your story. And I think that particular aspect of you, George, I want to lift that up too, because you're also an incredible artist. He sent me a basket in the mail recently that was so beautiful. It's now a centerpiece in our home, you know, and he told me what kind of trees they were and where he gathered them and the different colors and what, you know, what this was, this plant and this was this plant. And your relationship was so in there, you know, it wasn't just the basket. It was like a story and a place. And then your ability to nap, you know, flint nap, but I guess it's not flint, it's obsidian, these gorgeous replicas of these ancient points, which really caught Craig Foster's eye. He couldn't even believe that you were doing this. And and then George is a master sculptor too. His sculptures of bison, of wolves, of elk, you know, when you see them, you feel the aliveness of the story. It's not just a replica of something. It's alive. What's your reflection on the relationship of this kind of storytelling framework, multi-sensory experiencing, pulling it into your body? How does that affect you as an artist?
It's central. There's no way around it. And if I don't do it, I feel like a fraud. and I don't say that to demean anyone who does differently. I just say that's my way of doing it. That fills me up. It makes me feel whole. And not just whole as a person inside this skin, but whole as a person in the context of living in the landscape I do. Like, I never realized how many dogwoods lived on my property and had for years before I came to be a caretaker for it until I started weaving baskets. Oh my gosh, look at the dogwood there. That's a beautiful red. Oh, but that's like a cadmium red, and there's an alizarin red version over there. And it's like, oh my gosh, all of a sudden this land becomes populated with things that slipped by me before. So whatever it is, whether it's stone napping, you know, I messed around with that starting when I was 8 or 10, and I've done that forever. It has always been under the pretext of not having a thing. I really don't care to have even my own artwork a lot of times. I crave the process and the experience of what that reveals to me. My grandfather was a master storyteller, and I mean master storyteller. Like, it almost brings me to tears. He wouldn't have said that, but he was. And I watched it for years, just emulated and appreciated how he took inert information and made it matter to someone. And that's what I've always craved, is to not, I just don't want to be in a place. I want to be of it. Even if it's somewhere I'm traveling, I don't want to be the tourist. You know, we live at the doorstep of Yellowstone, and we all play the tourist. And for us, the summer is festooned with tourists. And you see how many people see a place full of wonders like a Yellowstone, and you realize they didn't even scratch the surface. They didn't even start. much less scratch the surface, much less get into the deeper layers. And I haven't either. I've been here over 20 years, and I still feel like I'm beginning. So the art to me is the excuse, whether it's making a basket or stone or ultimately a sculpture that'll be bronze. It gives me a place to put that beautiful line that comes down off the zygomatic arch, the cheekbone of a bison, down into the upper jaw. It gives me a place to take that view of a wolf that's just been confronted by a more dominant individual in the pack, and that subtle turn of the head and drop and the position of the tail and the balance of its weight on its feet. There's these things that don't have words. You can describe them till you're blue in the face, but they do not allow, I feel, access to the essence of it, much less the ability to really mull it over, process it, and assimilate it. So through my art, of whatever medium it is, I just cherish the ability to then use it to go deeper into the layers, to see what everybody's been missing, to see what I've been missing. And I have, like, for years I was doing pen and ink illustration, and I had a huge drawer full of reference photos I tore out of magazines for years, and this massive file reference. And at that point I was more or less just translating a photo into pen and ink. But it was astonishing to me. I could flip through thousands upon thousands of photos. And if I copied one of them, it is as if it was rimmed in neon lights. It jumped out of that folder in that drawer for some reason. Even if I'd forgotten I had done it, it's like, there's something to this. And I pull that out and I'm like, oh my gosh, yeah. I drew that as a reference for this other project. So that relationship of just investing your time and attention in something through art, whether it's music, you know, some people's art is in math, some people's art is in crochet, photography, that holds you in place long enough to get the good stuff.
Yeah, the idea of the Bushman talking about building ropes, you know, and threads become ropes of these relationships to these different living species. And what you're describing alludes to this idea that that's not just about living species. It's also about curiosities, about processes, you know, and when you describe art. And I like that you brought math in there too, because I think it's actually the process that you describe that is important, not the subject matter. It's this feeling of wanting to be drawn in, of wanting to go deeper, of almost needing it in our bodies to go deeper. And when we get in connection with that feeling, but then, of course, the next layer of the onion is revealed to us, right? And that process goes along. And I know I've experienced that with, you know, whether it's music or different elements of nature, or for me, for a long time when I was younger, it was baseball. I mean, literally has been math at certain times. And these things, they come and go. They're seasonal, right? For a while, we're drawn in a particular direction, and then we feel sort of complete with that. And it almost goes into hibernation for a little while. But then the next thing pops up. And so it's like this feeling we're describing, this desire to go deeper like that, it feels to me like it is speaking to sort of a deeper evolutionary truth about our humanity and the way in which we seek to deepen those connections with our world.
Yeah, well said. I think so. We just have this unending quest for truth, for one, and connection to that truth. And it's just when you submit to that journey, it leads you all kinds of amazing places that you just cannot plan for. Like I often tell people about, you know, I might have a black bear sculpture going, let's say, and I need to find a black bear to finish this sculpture. So I'll go out in the park. I often literally do take the sculptures out with me, pull them out, put them on a stand. But invariably when I go to find that black bear, I cannot find one. They might be everywhere for weeks and I can't find it. Like, oh my gosh. But then over time, learning to submit to everything that is there. The bear was my excuse, but then I see the cow, moose, and her calf. Like it's replaced with something as much or usually often greater in awe and beauty that I would have missed, you know, and it's a little bit of a task to rearrange your thinking that no, set aside your agenda and take what's given to you. Enjoy the gifts because they're so often more fulfilling than the reason you started the journey.
I'm so relating to this. And I think, you know, again, going back to Dr. Bill, he talks a lot about, you know, you can't access this place only from your thinking mind. You actually have to bring it into your body, like you said, into every soma, you know. And this back and forth between the curiosity of the intellectual mind and then that deep feeling, you know, that to me is the quintessential essence of connection, using both tools to the best of their ability, right? Because you're no stranger to rational reasoning and you're a really good problem solver. And, you know, some of the problems that George likes to solve, Sarah and I will be out at twilight here in California in the mountains where we are, and we'll hear a coyote, you know, doing a bark howl, and we'll be like, oh, that feels really agitated. Like, I think there's something there that coyote's really worried about. So we'll record it on our iPhone and then send the recording to George. And then George will call us right back and he'll be like, oh, take it from there, George.
That's how we all learn. It's so fun to know other folks who are willing to go the extra mile, because that's where so much good stuff is. And so, yeah, we've had a few of those exchanges. And for me living here in Yellowstone, you know, many of those years were spent as a guide. You know, so my job was to find somebody, a bear, a wolf. Well, how do you just go out there and know where a wolf or bear is? You know, and to most people, they're like, you don't, you can't. And that was an answer I didn't accept. I was like, there's ways, and it's taken me decades of largely studying on my own or meeting people and just putting pieces together and finding the area specific things for where I live. And one of them was coyotes. And one of the leading causes of death for coyotes is wolves in the wild. And you better believe they have a response to them and also corresponding vocalizations. And so I early on recognized this and then just started cataloging. You know, I can be hyper-focused and systematic about certain things. And like Aiden said, I'll go through butterflies, for instance. When we moved to Yellowstone, I was like, all right, the next 2 years, I'm opening the door to butterflies. I'm not studying them, but I'm going to pay attention to everywhere I see them, what colors, what sizes, what they're on, you know, and just start letting that seep in. And so similarly with coyote vocalizations, the neat thing about out here is you can see them. So you can see them howl and you can see the behavior they're exhibiting, and very quickly realize that when they say, that's all's well. Territory is primo. That's their song, if you will. That's our turf. Stay off it. And that will trigger coyotes in the next territory, in the next territory. And you have this coyote wave that goes down the valley. But then when a wolf shows up, it goes to... and on and on and on, to the point where I was like, ah, that's a wolf. And, you know, knowing many of the researchers in Yellowstone, which has been a real plus to navigate and understand certain aspects, that call was identified when the wolves were reintroduced to the park in 1995 by some coyote researchers, actually some of the armed guards who were keeping the wolves safe inside the pens from humans which there was never any issue, but they commented to the coyote researchers about these coyotes with quote-unquote sore throats barking and yelling at the wolves. That was this alarm bark, this bark howl. Lots of barking. And just to the point where I can be walking the dog and hear that across the upper Yellowstone Valley 3 miles away and be like, oh, there's some wolves over there. Get out the binoculars or spotting scope when I get home and yep, there it is. Oh, it's six or eight of them. It's a whole pack. But listening enough and even to the rarer instances, there's a version that John sent me that often sounds like a wolf-based alarm, but it's different. Same like with the squirrel vocalizations. There was something different about it. And it sounded something more like this. Still lots of barking, but kind of in the absence of a lot of the upturning and high pitches. And if your area is like ours, which I think John's is, that's what they say when there's a lion around.
Yeah, and because of this, you know, Sarah and I went tracking in the area that the coyotes were looking. And of course, we came upon fresh lion tracks, right? And, you know, this is the magic right here, folks, you know. One day, I sent George a video of a bird flying that my friend Gabe had taken on his land in the mountains here. And you could hear the ravens making a certain sound. You couldn't tell what bird it was because it was through an iPhone. It was really far away. But George said, well, if that was Yellowstone, that would be what ravens say for a golden eagle. And when I talked to my friend later, because he didn't send any explanation, he said, yeah, that was a golden eagle. I saw it fly over the property here and I got it on my iPhone. But George cued off the raven, which wasn't in the field. You know, it was just the sound the raven was making. And he had verified it before I got to talk to my friend who told me he was literally filming an eagle and sending it to me, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of neat. It adds a whole new dimension even to surfing YouTube. Like, people don't know what they catch. And that's the one cool thing about the modern age is the technology out there, as much as it drags us down in some areas, it does really help for sharing or documenting things. And, you know, I pull together periodically, sweep YouTube and look for coyote alarms, interactions with coyotes and other carnivores and people and dogs, and just made a playlist out of them. So I could refer back to them and be able to say certain things like what you just shared, John, because it takes more than any one of us to really learn this stuff. And I think that was one of the great things from Pescadero I learned. I was like, oh my gosh, like 70 people seriously learning bird language? Like, my whole life I've been learning this solo, and people go out with me and they never get to see anything. But when I went by myself, I'd see stuff. But in a different way, using other people, using technology, as much as I begrudge it at times, it has a place to give us experiences that we may not have the chance to directly experience, or at least in the number for us to realize, oh my gosh, that's what they say when there's a cougar, or that's what they say when there's a golden eagle. So as much as of a Luddite as I am and ensconced in a line of work that's not changed really much in 2,000 years, I have to confess, I held out until last Christmas with my flip phone, and I finally, Santa brought me a darn smartphone, and it does have its utilities. It's pretty darn neat for certain things, and like you're saying, it's, we get to share. You can share me, send me something and share. I can send something to you. John, what do you think of this? And send something to Craig Foster. Like, Craig, have you ever seen anything like this in Africa? It's a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. No, it really is. So how does Raven talk about the presence of a golden eagle?
Just to back up a little bit, I'll give you the baseline, sort of like I did with the coyote. It's important to understand what's normal. And I've stressed that with my own students. Like, what do you hear most of the time? Like, what's the animal you see and hear most of the time? Okay, well, how does that actually sound most of the time? Okay, well, it's when that changes, then you're holding an uncut gem in your hand. Your job is to figure out, why did it change? And so the ravens that, and I purposefully, having gone through graduate work in wildlife. I did not read any Raven literature when we moved to Yellowstone. I'd been in Raven country, but I did not want to see what others guided me to see. I wanted to see it, what the birds would teach me first and foremost. And so the Ravens day in and day out did this monotonous three note. Went on and on and on, and periodically it would change. Periodically it changed to this. And that, I could tell without even looking, was moving. And as I looked, I would see not one but two ravens. And that was a chase call of what a raven says when it's chasing another raven. So that was what I was seeing, you know, after three-note territorial call most commonly seen here. And that's where the onion starts to peel. It's like, okay, I've got that kind of embedded in my soma. What differences do I hear of that? And in one particular day, I remember the exact day and setting. I was at the union of our driveway with the neighbor's driveway, walking the dog, and I heard... It went on and on and on, very uniform notes, very little inflection beyond the ones in front and behind it. The spacing, which is, I think, a lot of people, same with music, right, Aiden? Like, silence, the gap between notes, can be as powerful as any note you can play. Same with speaking, right? Your cadence, your timbre, but when you stop. And so in this context, that sunny day is beautiful, clear sky, just like it is today. I looked up and I saw a golden eagle being chased by a single raven. I was like, ah, now I've got something to look for. Okay, does that happen every time a raven runs into a golden eagle? And as you kind of insinuated there, it just being aware of that possibility and paying attention to those few cases, because it doesn't show up very often. A tourist comes to Yellowstone and maybe in the span of a month, they might hear it if they were paying attention for it. Hmm. You know, so some of these things don't, this is sort of in line with a lot of rationale behind traditional ecological knowledge, is you got to hang around a long damn time to hear and see some of these relationships unfold. So I've always taken Auguste Rodin, the French sculptor, referred to as his approach to sculpture, which was proceeding like a glacier or water. And more accurately, I think he used the words of water wearing away stone. So kind of see something and then put it in your pocket and then just let it gestate and then just add other pieces to it as they come to you. So the cougar alarm by coyotes took me years. That probably took me a decade to realize that was going on.
Hmm.
The eagle stuff, I hear it once in a while, a couple times a year, but it's solid. Like, I was leading the butterfly count last year, which I do each year. And we were down near this power station, electrical power station. It's a wet area and it's beautiful habitat diversity for a lot of butterflies we don't get elsewhere in the count circle. And while my head was focused downward looking for bugs, I hear over top of my head, just like you're recording. And I was like, okay, let me test it. Look up. Yep, there's a raven chasing a golden eagle. Mm. And then, so peeling it even further, I think there's a difference between what they say for golden eagles and bald eagles. I think there's a difference between what they say for peregrine falcons versus red-tailed hawks. And I've recorded some of these, but I haven't fleshed those out as much.
Yeah, and we've compared notes on that. You know, I've seen the ravens on peregrines and totally different.
Yeah.
You know, again, you know, it's raven, so it's kind of similar to the other stuff ravens say, but there's a definite distinct pattern difference with the peregrine and with the red tail hawk, which is more common here. I get to see that red tail hawk raven interaction. But yeah, it's great. And so I think, you know, just going back to mimicry again from the beginning, it's like when you hear it in the field, I believe you're imitating it quietly to yourself. So you're storing it away so you don't lose it.
Absolutely.
Right. Because that's something that people don't think of. Like, I've always told people when we're teaching them bird language. When you hear something, imitate it, yeah. right? Just quietly to yourself so you don't disrupt, you know, the conversation of the wildlife. Yeah. So you just imitate it to yourself. When you get home and when you get in the car where no one can hear you, you imitate it at full volume, but you just keep imitating it and reliving it and reliving it because yeah. that's how we store these things. So they become part of our soma, right? Part of our body.
Yeah, I've noticed this certainly. I've had some pretty profound experiences, and some of which would get me in trouble if I told certain law enforcement or whatever entities about it. And those things I've noticed almost seem like they never existed because I don't tell anyone and I don't practice them or I don't revisit them, as you're saying, John. Like the when I hear those calls happening, like in Yellowstone, it's illegal to call to animals, you know, which I don't anyway, even on the national forest where you can do almost anything, because I don't want to disrupt it. I want to see what they're naturally doing. So when I encounter it in the future, I have a clear understanding of that signal. But you're right. You know, I do everything but make the sound. If you can hear me breathing on the mic, mm-hmm. but I'll run through that act of imitation, even though I'm not injecting myself into the equation. And you're right. Imitate it full force in the house later or inside a vehicle where it's okay to do that. That's essential.
That's essential. Important etiquette, important etiquette. We'll kind of start to wrap up here. I just wanted to mention George's book, which he honored me and asked me, would I write the foreword for this book? So I got to read this book as it was evolving many, many times. And Eavesdropping on Animals. And that is the publisher. I can't recall, George, but where do you find that book?
It's Greystone Press. And it will be available everywhere books are sold starting October 15th. Europe, Australia as well. Mm. And yeah, thank you so much for being a part of that journey, looking at early drafts and talking through ideas. And of course, for writing the foreword. It's really, in a lot of ways, the book I wish I had as a kid. It was something to kind of let me know what the possibilities were. And to shoot for them if I want to attain them. And it's been a great excuse to reach out to researchers and friends and revisit stories I hadn't heard in a long time and see if I still remembered them right. mm-hmm. And yeah, I encourage folks to check it out if they're interested. It's hopefully going to add to your experiences.
I know it's a great book. And one of the things that I think will really help the reader and the listener here is that George also gives you a recipe for how to get started in your own backyard kind of thing, you know? So I think you'll find it really helpful, and it's a wonderful read, and thanks for writing it, George. Cause like you said, it's the book that I wish I had when I was a kid, you know, cause when I was a boy, there was no one writing about bird language at all. The only person I found who wrote about it, Tom Brown wrote about it, but kind of in a generalized way. You know, he talked about it as concentric rings, that everything causes a wave that everything else reacts to. And, you know, you can learn to tell what's going on. But it was Jim Corbett in his book Jungle Lore and other books about man-eaters in Africa, in India, in, you know, leopards and tigers mostly. But he was very specific about what the chital deer would say and what the sambor would say and what the, you know, the rhesus, the monkey, I can't remember, I think it's rhesus macaque would say and what this bird would say when it was a tiger versus when it was a leopard, you know, and or when it was a bear. You know, I was like, oh, wow, somebody actually wrote about this stuff. But he was one of the only people who wrote about it in detail, you know, prior to What the Robin Knows, which came out in 2012, and now your book, you know. And there's other people who've done some really fantastic research. There's some great papers and articles, like the work of the man with the prairie dogs is just unbelievable. So, yeah, I just think it's a great gift to all of us. So thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure. It was what I thought would be 6 or 8 months worth of work and writing, and it was 2 years. And like John said, there's been so much research and, you know, work on by like Khan Slobodchikov on the prairie dogs and so many others now that have jumped on this bandwagon of, oh, animals are saying stuff and we can understand that and learn from it. Even if it isn't language in the way that so many want to define it, it still has meaning, a ton of meaning. And Yeah, it's not just communication. It's language. It's just their language, their version of it, rather than ours. Yeah, I ran into Corbett stuff later in life, but, you know, everything from, like, you'd see snippets of it, right, in different places. Like Henry Beston in The Outermost House writes of the calls that gulls and ducks would do when an eagle flew around. And there's an ethnographic write-up about the Gwich'in of Central Alaska, and that when they found a bear track, they would make a raven call to call the bear back out, making it think that they had found a carcass and food. I'm like, oh my gosh. Now I know, I'm pretty damn sure I know exactly what that call is. But you're right. Until you wrote that book and a student of mine handed me a copy of it, and I was like, oh boy, yeah. I remember this guy. He made a couple tapes back about 20 years ago. At that time, it would have been 10 or 12 years ago. I was like, oh, I got to read this one. Because, yeah, like Corbett's, I should say, yours has been one of the only ones that's dove into that. So my kudos and gratitude go to you for putting time into writing What the Robin Knows. That was a game changer for me. It brought together so much of what I'd gotten tattered pieces of. I was like, oh my gosh, look for that. Look for that pattern. Look for this pattern. It's like what we do for each other in the best of ways is just ratchet each other up, let each other stand on one another's shoulders when we need to. So thanks. Yeah.
Yeah. And, thank you, George. Yeah.
It's my pleasure. There's more will be on the book, and actually I'm in the process of accumulating the recordings to go along with the book. But for folks who want to learn more about the book, you can just go to georgebuman.com. Buman is spelled B-U-M-A-N-N, two N's, /wild-conversations. So if you're web-oriented and want to go that route, you can.
Fantastic.
Thanks for having me on. This has been a fun conversation.
Yeah, thank you, George. And for folks out there listening, we're going to make sure we have all of the appropriate links here in the show notes so you can get those thereafter. You don't have to like swerve off to the side of the road and pause the podcast and scribble it down. So, yeah, and thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Right on. Remember, everyone, from Joe Ellis at the Audubon Society, he listened to a talk I gave on bird language for 45 minutes, and he said, I think what you just said was, birds talk to each other, we can understand it, and it's fun. That's what you'll get from reading Eavesdropping on Animals. So thanks, George. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Tracking Connections. If you enjoy this podcast, it would mean a lot to us if you would take a minute to follow or subscribe. Following the podcast helps us, and it helps you, because you'll never miss an episode. We'd also love for you to give us a 5-star rating and review and share an episode with a friend. To learn more about our current offerings, visit livingconnectionfirst.net. We'll see you next time.